Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Flory, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This panel of the court today has six cases on its agenda, four of which will be submitted with oral arguments and two of which will be submitted without oral arguments, solely on the briefs. The first case set for oral arguments is number A19-47, Sywick Lumber and Millwork, Inc. versus Blue Water Holdings, LLC, and others. Counsel for appellant cross respondent over here. You may approach and begin, and please identify yourself at the beginning of your arguments.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jared Gorlitz, and I am the counsel for Pine Financial Group in this matter. Before the court today is a case with a somewhat tortured procedural history, motions for summary judgment, motion to reconsider, and even a partial trial that involves a unique and rare legal issue. Although this court has been faced with various foreclosure-related issues from the last recession, this case deals with a foreclosure surplus and whether that exists from the foreclosure or not. My client, Pine Financial Group, is a lender. It's a commercial lender. The respondents, CG Architects and Blue Water, are the owners of these properties, and they obtained the funds from my client. All the parties here are sophisticated in the sense that we're not dealing with homeowners on residential property that may be unfamiliar with the kind of logistics of the documents at issue. As I indicated, my client's a lender, and it lent money for construction on these properties. Some of the money was used to pay off prior liens or prior loans or to buy the property, and some of the money was placed into a separate escrow account. That escrow account had its own separate document. It's called a construction escrow agreement, a repair escrow agreement, and it has various terms and conditions as agreed to by the parties. When my client foreclosed, it bid the total debt advanced. So it bid the total amount that was owed on the note and the mortgage, and it did not deduct any of the money left in this escrow account. And the reason for that was the construction escrow agreement indicated it could retain those funds and use them for the purposes of completing construction, which my client did. It did complete construction on these properties, and that was the issue that was being tried when the court entertained this motion to reconsider. The positions are that my client believes that the money in the escrow account has a separate and distinct legal relationship, allowing it to retain those funds and using it to complete construction. Points to the statutes, the foreclosure statutes that relate to what a mortgage debt is that is satisfied from the foreclosure. We point to the specific contract provisions in the both the note and the mortgage and how those relate to the foreclosure laws. We also point to the specific contract provisions in the escrow agreements and
well,
why my...
if that's the case, Mr. Gorlitz, then why did your client bid the full amount rather than the full amount less what was in escrow if it was going to retain those funds anyway to finish the construction?
The simple answer...
Windfall.
I don't think it's a windfall, and I'll get to that in a moment. But the reason it did so is its contract said it could. In the event of a default, it says they're allowed to retain the funds and use them to complete construction. And it has there isn't a windfall because although it took the property back, it only gets a windfall if it doesn't use the money to complete construction. I would agree with you if you said, counsel, your client kept this money in escrow and took the property. Then I would agree we get a windfall. And if the escrow agreement said that, I would agree with you that that provision is borderline unconscionable. That's not fair. That is a windfall. But here the difference is my client's only allowed to keep that money if it's using it for the purposes of completing construction.
But doesn't the promissory notes set out the limit of the loan, the amount? But then there's language in those promissory notes that something to the effect, you know, the amount borrowed, $600,000 or whatever it was, or so much thereof as is advanced under this agreement.
Correct.
And it seems like there's no issue of fact that the full amount was never advanced on either of these agreements.
That's a legally incorrect statement, Your Honor, and here's why. The amount, my client takes money, the debt, under the promissory note and puts it over here in an escrow account. If you were at his deposition, he'd say, I'm a lender, I got to make sure I have money in this escrow account to pay under this escrow agreement if construction's completed. So as a matter of law, under the promissory note, when the money is advanced into the escrow account, it shows up as an advance, an obligation by the borrower to the lender. So under the note, that money is owed, and that money accrues interest, and it's our position, there's a legal right for us to collect that amount of money. Over here in the escrow is where that money's placed, and that's under the escrow agreement. And that money then gets released pursuant to the terms of the escrow agreement. You get a certain percentage of construction completed, you do certain things, you can then use that money to complete construction. So the language you're talking about under the promissory note is legally different than the situation we're dealing with, and that's because it was advanced under the note, and I think everybody or counsel will acknowledge that that money was advanced under the note, meaning it was part of the principal that was due. And that's why, in our brief, we focus on what does that mean in the context of the foreclosure statutes? Because that money was advanced, and because it was due, and because it accrued interest under the note, that's part of the mortgage debt. And so we satisfied the Minnesota statute by bidding that amount of money towards the mortgage debt. And that amount, we would indicate, was satisfied. The mortgage debt was satisfied. Really, this case, in my opinion, isn't about surplus, it's about contracts. Under this escrow agreement, can we legally do what we did? Because under the note and the mortgage, I don't see how we did anything wrong. The mortgage debt is the money that was advanced. All the money that was in the escrow agreement was advanced under the terms of the note, and we bid that at the time of the sale. That issue's done. The question is a contractual one. Under the escrow agreement, are we allowed to do what we did? And it's our position we are. Under the terms of that escrow agreement, it says, in the event of a default, lender, you can retain this money and use it for escrow. Under the terms of this agreement, you can have cumulative remedies. You can do what you did. And the only distinction here, I really think, is if my client was a third-party escrow agent, maybe a title company is how you generally see them, I don't think we have this discussion. But because my client is acting under two different hats, lender and escrow agent, that's why there's this idea that they've done something wrong. Because if this was money really held with a title company, the same terms and conditions would apply, and they would hold them. They would have them. And if it said the lender's allowed to use these to complete construction or, you know, give them back to the borrower or whatever, you know, then I don't think we have this discussion. But because my client wore both hats is why I think it's confusing.
Are you saying that the record supports that of the amount of the note, certain amounts were paid at the time of closing?
Correct.
Are you saying that the difference between those amounts that were paid at the time of closing was all advanced into the escrow account to equal the amount of the note?
On both notes, all the monies were advanced and placed into escrow. Some of the money in escrow was then dispersed, and some of it remained. And there's distinguishable between which property which applies. But, my position is the record supports all the money was advanced on both loans. All money's advanced accrued interest, and there's been no dispute that we can't collect interest on that.
I don't think the district court agreed with that position, though. Did they, that it was all advanced?
You'd have to point me to where the district court didn't agree with that. I don't know that the district court necessarily understood the dynamic of what was going on. But my position, the record
instance,
is very...
On the Abbott property, yep. When I read the district court's order, $175,000 was to be distributed to the escrow account, but only $140,000 was distributed. Do you agree with those findings of the court?
No, and here's why. I would say that the full $175,000 was distributed. The distinction, Your Honor, is $140,000 was advanced after the closing, and $35,000 was advanced at the closing. I believe the record supports that. If you look at the accounting from the sworn settlement statements as well as the escrow agreement. So some of the money was advanced at closing. I believe for the Abbott property, I'd have to look specifically at the escrow agreement to show, but I want to say $17,500 was advanced at closing for like permits and initial construction costs, and then another $17,500 was advanced for something else. So I do disagree with the district court. The full $175,000 was advanced, and the full $175,000 was placed And it wasn't placed in the escrow account because it just happened at the time of closing. So, you know, the full 175 was advanced. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. So it's our position that other than this abstract view that we've somehow, you know, have this unjustified windfall or that we've taken money that's not ours, that's just an abstract view. When you get down to the foreclosure statutes, which deal with quote-unquote mortgage debt and what exists respect to mortgage debt, and you get down to these contracts and what terms apply and who has what rights, my client did not do anything wrong. It retained the funds. The contract said they could retain the funds under the surplus statute. That's a separate issue. It bid full debt. And I didn't see the district court point to any contract provision that said we couldn't do what we wanted to do. They can't point to any statute that says we couldn't do what we did. And they can't point to any law. They just rely on this abstract equitable view that we just don't think this should happen because you've taken money. And I would urge this court to really look at that issue because my client hasn't taken any money. It only takes the money if it puts it in its pocket and it runs away. When it uses it to complete construction, all it's doing is enforcing the rights that were bargained for. And here, why that's important is my client bargained for a loan on a property that had construction completed. And so its concept is, when I get rid of this property, I want construction completed. I didn't loan money on a property that was 70% done or 80% done. When I turn around and sell it, I want a property that's fully completed so I can recover my money. And if the economics of it shows that my client didn't profit from this, and so, you know, my client definitely agrees with this belief that it's got some, unjustified windfall because at the end of the day, does not receive any sort of windfall. The other issue I want to focus on as briefly is our right to attorney's fees on the mechanic lien claims. There's no dispute here. My client bought some mechanic liens to use as an offset to the extent it loses the surplus issue. There's no dispute about that. We own these mechanic liens. We bought them, and we, under the law, have a right to offset them.
And the district court agreed with you on that.
They did. But what didn't agree with us is whether we have a right to attorney's fees. I should clarify. The district court agreed that my client can offset the mechanic lien claims and agreed that my client has a right to attorney's fees under the mechanic lien statute, but then said, under the totality of the circumstances, we're not giving you attorney's fees, which was an issue not even raised by the respondents. It was an issue the court totally took upon itself, which is part of our appeal. But it's our position that this totality of circumstances position is an abuse of discretion. My client wears different hats in that instance as well. It is a lender, and there's no dispute about that. It's also a mechanic lien holder. If I was standing here today as Sywick Lumber or Apollo Heating Air Conditioning and saying I should have attorney's fees, the court doesn't go to totality of the circumstances. Why? Because I'm wearing a different hat. I'm a junior creditor, has a right to be paid. And this court said, well, I'm not even going to look at that. I'm going to look at you as the lender and what we think you caused this surplus. You shouldn't benefit from it. Those are totally separate issues, completely separate issues, and it should not be part of the analysis as to whether my client's entitled to attorney's fees. And it's our position the court abused its discretion by not allowing us attorney's fees. Now, I also believe that the record supports that the reasonableness of our attorney's fees was undisputed. The record at oral argument and through the briefing indicated that respondents did not object to the amount of our attorney's fees. Their position was that we were not legally entitled to those attorney's fees as a matter of statute. And so we should have been granted our attorney's fees. They were undisputed. We were legally entitled to them, and this totality of circumstances argument was an abuse of discretion. And finally, on this issue of attorney's fees with respect to the mechanic lien statute, the argument in the cross-respondent reply brief was that we have it wrong and that attorney's fees are only allowed under the mechanic lien statute if you foreclose. I disagree with that position. Minnesota statute 514.14 does not have a requirement that you foreclose. I will concede that if you look at every case as it relates to mechanic lien claims being titled attorney's fees, it always talks about it in the context of foreclosure. And that makes sense. Every single mechanic lien case that's probably ever been up to the Court of Appeals or decided has dealt with attorney's fees in the context of a mechanic lien foreclosure. Here we have a unique situation in that we're arguing we have a valid mechanic lien for the purposes of the surplus, and we're entitled to our attorney's fees because we had to basically prove up our mechanic lien claims for the purposes of the surplus. The statute does not say that your right to attorney's fees is limited to foreclosure. And if you look at the, if you look at Minnesota Statute 514.14, and I'm sure the court's familiar with this, it doesn't even say you have a right to attorney's fees at all. That's been borne out through the case law over the last 100 years. What I would encourage this court to do is look at the originating case from 100 years ago that gave that, interpreted Minnesota Statute 514.14, in essence, its predecessor regarding attorney's fees, and it's the Schmoll versus Luke case, and I didn't cite it because it didn't come up until their reply. It's from 1908. It's 106 Min 188. The point I want to make is if you look at that case, it's not, it doesn't say that you only get attorney's fees if you foreclose. It simply interprets the same language that we've interpreted for our argument and said we have a right to attorney's fees. The court in that case looked at the language and said, yes, we agree that mechanic lien claimants have a right to attorney's fees. My time's up, and I'll...
That's one question. Mm-hmm. I have one question for you, Mr. Gorelitz.
Yes.
This goes back to the surplus. Assuming we disagree with you on the issue of whether there was a surplus or not, if there was a surplus, other than the district court's determinations regarding late fees and interest calculation, do you dispute any other determinations that the court made in arriving at the amount of the surplus?
The only other thing that I can think of offhand that's not, that you didn't pick up on was this, the insurance, the forced place insurance. It's our position that we should have been, that's a common expense that lenders would have in this instance. It should have been an expense that would be added to the amount that was owed, and the court, district court erred when it did not include that.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gorelitz. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Mr. Gorelitz, my name is William Topka, and I represent CG Architects and Blue Water Holdings in this particular case. And I'd like to pick up where Mr. Gorelitz left off, talking about the attorney's fees for the mechanics lien claims, because I think we can easily deal with that. The point that we made at the district court level and that we tried to make here is that a mechanics lien claimant, which we admit that Pine Financial is, can only obtain an award of attorney's fees if it is a successful lien claimant. That's what the case law bears out. So what exactly is a successful lien claimant? Well, to be able to answer that question, you have to turn to the statute. The statute allows a mechanics lien claimant to essentially obtain a judgment for foreclosure. Whether you want to call it a judgment or whether you wanted to call it a foreclosure, it's one and the same. You get a judgment, and that judgment's not for money. That judgment is for foreclosure. And so the point being that to be able to be a successful lien claimant, you have to be able to successfully obtain a judgment. And to obtain that judgment, you have to have a lien that you can foreclose. Neither Sywick nor Apollo, the two liens that Pine Financial purchased, had liens that could legally be foreclosed. And the reason is simple. Pine, as the lender, was the superior lien holder. It foreclosed on the mortgages. When it foreclosed on the mortgages, that foreclosure extinguished all subsequent liens. Under the mechanics lien statute, they were extinguished unless they redeemed. There's no dispute that the mechanics liens claimants did not redeem. So when Sywick, when Apollo started their foreclosure actions, they could have never been successful because they could have never obtained a judgment allowing them to foreclose. And it's for that reason that Pine Financial is not entitled to its attorney's fees. And it's a legal issue. Mr. Gorelitz is right. We did not dispute the reasonableness of the fees at the district court level. We differ with Pine Financial's analysis that we think that the district court has broad discretion in determining whether or not those fees are reasonable, even if my clients didn't dispute them. But we believe that the underpinnings are what prevents Pine Financial from attaining its attorney's fees, that being it could have never been a successful lien claimant. Going back to the question that the court asked about the surplus, Your Honor asked about whether or not all of the money was advanced. And Pine Financial is splitting hairs. There's a question as to what the word advanced means. Pine Financial wants the court to believe and made this argument at the district court level that advanced means that we placed it into the escrow agreement. Where I think the case law bears out, and I think the common understanding of the word advanced is that Pine Financial took that money out of its pocket, gave it to a third party, whether it was my clients, whether it was a subcontractor, whomever it was. So the question of whether or not this money was advanced or not is not as simple as Pine Financial is making it. The money was placed into an escrow account, but it wasn't dispersed. It's my client's argument that the word advanced means dispersed to third parties, not simply we're going to take it from our left pocket and we're going to put it into our right pocket. So, but even so, whether it was advanced or whether it wasn't, the way I interpret Pine Financial's position is that I don't know that they're actually disputing that there was a surplus. And if you look at their arguments, they make an argument that, well, if a third party comes in at the sheriff's sale, and if they bid, and they're the successful bidder, then Pine Financial would have had to give the money that was in the escrow account to CG Architects and to Blue Water. And well, why is that? Well, because there would have been a surplus otherwise. And so I don't think they're necessarily disputing that what there was a surplus. I think what they're doing is they're saying, well, under the construction escrow agreement, we're entitled to keep that surplus because of this very language that's in there. And so if you take that to its logical conclusion, if the construction escrow agreement isn't enforceable for whatever reason, then they don't have a defense to the surplus. And it's our position that the construction escrow agreement isn't enforceable because Pine elected its remedy by foreclosing. So once it foreclosed, it could no longer go back and enforce any of the terms of the note. It couldn't enforce any of the terms of the mortgage, and Pine will agree with that. They'll readily agree that once they foreclose, the redemption period expires, they can't sue on the note, and they can't do anything else under the mortgage. Where we start to get into a bit of a rub is that Pine Financial wants to distinguish the construction escrow agreement from the note and mortgage, essentially claiming, well, it's a separate set of rights that we had. So when we foreclosed, we still had the rights under this separate agreement. But as the district court pointed out, all of these documents were part of the same transaction or occurrence, that Pine Financial's not going to give the loan without the construction escrow agreement, that Pine Financial's not going to give the loan without the note and without the mortgage. And even if you turn to the terms of the construction escrow agreement itself, it indicates that that agreement is a condition precedent to the loan. It says, whereas, as a condition precedent to lender's funding of the loan, borrower has agreed to this agreement. So this construction escrow agreement was all part of the same transaction. What Pine is essentially trying to argue is that, take a simple example. I receive a personal loan. I give the bank security in the form of a mortgage on my house and a lien on my car. Well, if I don't pay and the bank forecloses on my house and takes it in full satisfaction of the debt that I owe, it can't subsequently foreclose the lien on my car. And that's what Pine Financial is trying to do. It's all part of the same transaction or occurrence. So we don't necessarily see how Pine Financial can argue that this is some separate set of rights when it's really not. They're all integrated. Whether it was in a separate agreement or whether they were all in one document that was 55 pages long, Pine Financial's not giving the loan without all three of these documents. When it foreclosed, it took that property in satisfaction of everything. It can't subsequently now try to enforce the terms of the construction escrow agreement. If it wanted to, it could have. It could have taken that money back, and it could have applied it to the loan. It could have applied it to construction, but you got to do that before you foreclose. Because once you foreclose, that's it. You take it in full satisfaction of everything. And I think that's a simple way that we can look at it.
I have a question on the record. This is a little bit related to what you're talking about here, but we've been through the record in detail, and there is a letter in the record from Pine Financial dated October 30th of 2014 to CG entitled Notice of Default and Notice of Acceleration. I have been unable to locate any other record, a similar letter to Blue Water. Do you dispute whether Blue Water was put on notice of the default and acceleration? And if not, was it at the same time?
No, Your Honor, we do not dispute that Blue Water was put on notice. And if I remember correctly, there was a separate letter that I remember seeing somewhere. I don't know where it was in the record. I don't think it was dated the same. I think they were about a month apart, and Mr. Gerlitz can probably clarify this when he gets up on his rebuttal.
I'm going to ask him the same question, but we ran out of time.
Yeah, but I think they were about a month apart, and I can't remember which one was first and which one was second, but I do believe that there were two letters. And one of the other issues that my clients brought up on their cross appeal is what I believe to be a relatively interesting issue, is whether or not the mechanics lien claimants get paid out of the surplus. And I understand Pine Financial's argument that Shaw Acquisition stands for the proposition that mechanics lien claimants have to get paid out of the surplus. But we don't believe that's necessarily the case, because we don't believe that the Supreme Court had the opportunity to make the analysis that we're making now. There's two surplus statutes, 580.09, 580.10. 09 deals with foreclosing a single installment or multiple installments, to where 580.10, which is at issue here, is foreclosing on the entire note. Before 1925, both statutes had exactly the same language, identical. They had this legal successors and assigns language. But in 1925, the legislature amended 580.09 and added some relatively interesting language. It added this phrase, subsequent liens, and didn't add that particular language to 580.10 for whatever reason. So the question is what exactly does adding that language mean? Because the canons of construction are clear that when the legislature does something and it changes words in a statute, that we have to assume that it did that for a particular reason. So why did it add the phrase subsequent liens? Well, it had to have added it because legal successors and assigns didn't cover some category that the legislature wanted it to cover. And so if you look at Brown v. Crookston, that particular case talks about whether or not legal successors and assigns and how that works, and it's our position that case says that, well, only voluntary liens are fall within that language. And so it's our position that the legislature added this language to 580.09 so that it could encompass all liens, because there's no dispute that a mechanic lien is a subsequent liener, right? It's a lien that was recorded after the lien that's foreclosing.
But the question I have about that, Mr. Topka, is your client was distributed $180,000 out of the escrow account for payment to contractors like Switek and Apollo, and they never paid those bills despite that money being distributed. So how is it error to say you should have paid those bills, and so to the extent there's a surplus, that's being deducted from the surplus? It just seems like they were given the money for that. They didn't pay those contractors, and it doesn't seem like that should be Pine Financial's responsibility.
That's a fair question, Your Honor, and my answer to that would be this. It's not as simple as they did work, Pine Financial paid for it. So the way the disbursements worked under the terms of the agreement was that some of it had to be done before you submitted a request for payment. But you can't construct a building like that. So some of it you have to start work before you submit requests. CG Architects and Blue Water had a heck of a time getting these requests approved. And so it's not necessarily the case that Pine Financial paid for this particular work. It's very possible, and I don't know that the record is particularly clear on this issue, that the work was done and that Pine Financial did not pay for it. It's quite possible that that happened. And unless the court has any further questions, I have no further comments.
Thank you very much, Mr. Topka.
Thank you.
Mr. Gerlitz, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. Again, I'm Jared Gorlitz, and I represent the appellant Pine Financial Group. The first issue I want to deal with is this idea that this money wasn't advanced under the note. And I don't know how this court could possibly reach that conclusion. If you look at addendum page 42 in our brief, it's the promissory note on the one of the loans. It's the CG Architects loan. You can't read that note and not understand that the paragraph dealing with advances is not an advance into the construction escrow agreement. If you look specifically in paragraph 3, dealing with interest paid, payments, and accrual, it talks specifically about money advanced is going to accrue interest, and that money advanced is going into the construction loan agreement. It was advanced. There's no question about that. The problem is how does that relate to the foreclosure? And you got to go to Minnesota Statute 580.225, and that's the statute that determines whether there's a surplus in this case or not. And neither the court nor the respondents have ever explained how we've did bid more money than what was owed on the mortgage debt. The mortgage debt is the amount owed under the note and the mortgage. And there's no dispute here that this money was advanced under the note and the mortgage, and we bid that amount. There is no surplus. And the only way this court can determine that there is a surplus is that we somehow didn't bid money on the mortgage debt. You would have to say, well, just because the note says advanced, you didn't advance the money. Well, that contradicts the language in the note. And that's my problem with the argument of respondents and the district court. They want to amend the note, and they want to amend the mortgage to now make their argument that there's a surplus. And I get on its face, it's like, well, you got this money and you got it two different places. But my client has to use the money for completing construction. And just because we don't like it, those were the terms that the parties agreed to in the construction escrow agreement. They said, in the event of a default, you can retain this money and you can use it to complete construction. And your remedies are cumulative. Now, let's briefly talk about whether there has been an election of remedies. The only way an election of remedies comes up, whether it's even before this court and was properly through the district court, is a separate issue, and that's, I'll leave to my briefing on that. But what's an election of remedies? Two or more coexisting and inconsistent remedies. So in order for them to establish that we've elected a remedy to foreclose and we can't keep the remedy, keep the money in the escrow, you have to show that those are inconsistent remedies. Well, how are they inconsistent? Well, if you put the money in your pocket and you don't use it to complete construction, I would agree with you. Now they're inconsistent, right? You can't double dip. It is absolutely consistent if they use the money to complete construction. That was the deal the parties agreed to. That's what's in the documents. The idea was you're going to take this money and use it to complete construction. And now my client, after the foreclosure sale, is authorized to go and complete construction. They're not putting the money in their pocket. They're putting money into the property where it was originally supposed to go, to complete construction. And what are they getting? The same property that they would have gotten had the respondents' parties actually completed construction. So in the event that there was a default after all the money had been paid out of the escrow agreement, and now we foreclose, there's no difference. The same result happens. There was a default, my client gets the property back, and he gets the property in the condition that it anticipated it would get, and that's with construction completed, so it can recover the money that's were owed. It doesn't double dip, it doesn't create an inconsistent remedy, it doesn't put any money in its pocket. Now, the issue before the court at the trial was, did we really use the money to complete construction? We still have to prove up that issue upon remand. But again, there is nothing in this record and there's nothing in the law that says what we did creates some sort of inconsistent remedy. Briefly, with respect to the issue on the letters, I don't recall if it's in the record or not. I think the documents just might have been understood between the parties as it's not an issue of fact, right? I don't think there's a dispute that we had a right, that we accelerated and had a right to foreclose, and I believe Mr. Topka conceded that. Finally, on this, you know, successors and assigns language, I'll predominantly rely on my brief, but I do want to echo to the court that I agree that this money actually was supposed to go to Sywick and Apollo. If you follow the money escrowed and you follow where it was supposed to go, it should have went to those liens. So we advanced the money to pay them, and the reason we ended up in this mess is because people weren't getting paid, construction's over budget, and my client says that we got a problem here, we're not escrowing more money, this loan's in default, and we're going to move on. And they foreclosed. In the totality of the circumstances, I think there has been no surplus established. The contract and the statutes support my client's position. This matter should be remanded. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gerlich. Thank you to both counsel. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days as required by statute.